Thank you, Ashton, for raising the battle cry. I hope everybody in the room is ready to go forth. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We now have some time for questions, and the ushers are going to go around and collect your yellow cards with questions. And as they're doing that, let me sort of kick things off a little. Ashton, you gave a few suggestions on what people walking out of the door can do today. Here's a hard one for you. Do we have to give up our senior discounts?
This would be the moment for me to brandish. I turn 65 in June, and I have my senior Metro card. I'm super proud of it. It's a good, in theory, are senior discounts ageist? That's a hard question. In theory, yes. You know, it should be, they should be, discounts should be awarded according to your individual economic standing, not by age. Just like, in theory, anyone of any age should be able to apply to the Army. But, of course, bureaucracies need rules. I love my senior discount.
Go forth. Because they're important in New Hampshire. Another aspect of aging that is difficult for many of us to address is the ageism that happens in the healthcare scene itself. It's in part because there's a lot of money made off of ageism. How can we, in our delicate relationship with our healthcare providers, teach them?
Well, there is money to be, I mean, in the broadest sense, when aging is described to us as a problem, we can be persuaded to buy stuff to fix it. You know, if you're, like wrinkles, for example, we better do something about them. It's profitable, right? If aging is framed as a disease, then we can be sold stuff to cure it. So the first thing to do is to question the narrative that aging itself is a disease. If aging were a disease, living would be a disease. Health-related conditions do crop up, but again, each person is different. The odds of anyone, no single person comes down with all the conditions of aging, right? So if your doctor says, well, at your age, what do you expect? Fire your doctor and find another one. Watch out for your own tendency to blame things on age that may not be age-related. I stole this gag from Robert Butler, who invented the term ageism. He said, my other knee, I stopped blaming my sore knee on being 65 because my other knee doesn't hurt and it's just as old. Right? So when we bring expectations of age-related decline to the doctor, that said, the medical establishment is incredibly ageist. There is a whole, and in fairness, they are often people dealing with the most debilitated end of the spectrum. There is a whole chapter in my book about ageism in healthcare in particular, and what it looks like and how to challenge it. I have a clipboard going around with a mailing list. If you give me your email, I will never give it away, and I will only get it together to send an email about once every 3 months if you want to hear how the movement is coming.
Okay, we're starting to get some questions from the audience that are quite interesting.
Uh-oh.
The first is, how do young people respond to your work? Are they willing to think about it?
That's a great question. Very much so, because young people feel age discrimination very acutely. I mean, I always think of, as a teenager, how I was totally preoccupied with fairness and how, you know, that's when you sort of learn that things don't always shake out the way you think they should. And every time we think a young person is too young to have an opinion or to be qualified, that's ageism. And one of the reasons I'm optimistic about this movement is that the idea of diversity, I think, is our kids know that diversity is here to stay and have a sense of the ways in which it's changing the world around us. It is not a hard sell to young people to say, well, age is a criterion for diversity, right? None of them say, oh, that's a dumb idea. They want a world in which what you look like doesn't hamper access to opportunity. And they understand that the way people think about them, I mean, how often do you hear millennials are so selfish? Millennials need their hands held. Millennials can't, you know, that's just as ageist as that boomers are selfish and greedy. Those stereotypes pit us against each other. So the young and old are natural allies. And I think that sense comes much more readily to the younger generation than it does to ours, which I think is a fantastic thing.
There have been several questions from the audience that I'm going to try and lump together because it's about other parts in the world and other cultures. So the question is, in your research, what have you learned in researching other societies around the world and how they treat ageism, and what can we learn from them?
There are cultures, and people always think of China and the Far East, where there is a tradition of ancestor worship or Confucianism, where older members of society are venerated. One and another place where there tends to be less ageism are smaller communities where there's no age segregation. If you live in a community where people of all ages are out and about doing stuff, you don't think, it's obvious just when you look around that people of all ages contribute in different ways. And also you're exposed to people of all ages, so it's very hard for stereotypes to take root. Urbanization is undermining that, and so is capitalism. I think we think of China as some place where older people are venerated. But as capitalism changes life in China, younger people are moving to the cities, leaving the very old and the very young in the country, and setting the stage for ageism. So everywhere that those trends are paramount, it's especially important to rise up against ageism. It's also important to remember that in societies with a strong, that like early America, was a gerontocracy, older people held the power. And that even though that sounds kind of great for a minute, it's not fun to be a young person in that society, to have to wait for your father to die to inherit, or have the older brother be the only person who inherits. What we want is a society where power, where the real and legitimate differences between old and young are recognized and acknowledged, but not organized into a system of inequity, right? We need to figure out ways where younger people in the workforce can rise, but where seniority and knowledge is still respected. And just one thing, it's important to realize it's not all ageism. These longer lives are a new phenomenon, right? And it takes time for culture and society to catch up. And so what's really important is that our solutions to them are not these hand-wringing, oh my gosh, population aging is a disaster, which is the ageism frame scenario, but one that sees this as not just a challenge, a legitimate challenge, but an incredible opportunity to have millions and millions more healthy, well-educated adults all around the world than we have ever had.
That leads to the next question on the card that I have, which is, how do we, in a society with head and heart, justify the cost when you're balancing young against old?
The cost of what?
Of keeping people alive and providing health care. This is sort of a quantifying economic perspective on ageism.
Well, it sounds to me, maybe I have it wrong, but that the underlying assumption there is that the life of an older person is worth less than the life of a younger person, and I reject that. I think that every human being has value, whether they're old or young, whether they're disabled or not, whether they're black or white, and we have to operate from that premise.
So that is another interesting thought for the whole audience. And the final question, which is, how do we organize against ageism, racism, anti-Semitism, otherisms in both the local area, the state, and on a national level?
I love that question. I suspect many people in this audience had more than a few dark nights of the soul after the election in November. And I thought, do we really have time or energy for another ism when so many call out for attention, racism in particular? And what I realized was two things. We don't have to choose. When we make the world a better place to grow old in, we make it a better place in which to have a disability. We make it a better place in which to be poor or to be from somewhere else or to be queer. When you chip away at the basis of any prejudice, you erode the prejudice for them all. And a very practical, sort of tactical counterpoint to that is when we come together at all ages, for whatever the cause, setting up a community health center, save the whales, start a park, whatever it happens to be. If we make sure that there are all ages around the table, we dismantle ageism in the process. right? You don't need a separate movement.
Now, let's take it from the global, because there are two questions here that came in more on the personal, which is talking about dyeing our hair and using skin creams. Is it ever okay?
I have lucky enough to be staying last night with my daughter's in-laws in Amherst, and I was borrowing a makeup mirror with my daughter's daughter-in-law, and was saying, you know, I am a lot less doctrinaire about a lot of things than I used to be. Whatever you do is fine. If we were to say altering our appearance was not okay, then it wouldn't be okay to use makeup. It's a slippery slope with Botox and cosmetic surgery. I had this moment of, you know, sort of awareness. I was coming out of a movie theater in New York that has an escalator, middle of the day, so a lot of older people, and I only saw one white head among the women. And I thought, and it's true, this is one way we collude in making ourselves invisible as older women. And when a population is invisible, so are the issues that affect them. And I thought, wouldn't it be, and if you think about how many people actually have white hair, if you could wave wasn't there a kid's toy where you could wave something and it would turn one color? If the world knew how many olders there were to identify us by the very crude, you know, metric of gray hair, we wouldn't be a minority anymore by any means. So I thought, wouldn't it be amazing to have the year of letting our hair go gray? And I put that on Facebook and I got a ton of blowback. I was like, you know, that's a terrible idea. I would lose my job. I have children to support. My hair is ugly. You go first. So I did. I dyed my hair white because I actually still have brown hair. The white hair is put in, but I wanted to see what it was like. And I have learned not to tell people what they should do with their appearance, because if there is one stereotype I could banish, it is this absurd thing that all old people are alike. It is why I so dislike the term the elderly, right? We each age in our own way, at our own time. If dyeing your hair makes you happy, dye your hair. If getting Botox makes you feel happy when you look in the mirror, fine. But I hope also, it's seriously, fine, no judgment. Because, and lots of people do, you know, it is true that we look older if we have gray hair in an ageist world. You know, I hope to get to a place where we don't feel we have to do that, because we're not ashamed of it, because we shouldn't be ashamed of it, and because a lot of gray hair and white hair is absolutely gorgeous. But it's going to be an incremental change that we all have to embark on in our own way, at our own speed.
You reminded me of an elder advocate in Manchester who was very successful in getting a single senior center started. And she did that by encouraging all of her friends to go to a mayor and alderman meeting and just stand in the back of the room with all their white heads. She said, they're the Q-tips.
Ah, there we go.
Okay, the questions keep coming. And, you know, Ashton, there is one area where it is actually legal to have ageism, and that is in the field of housing, because there are actually federal dollars that are available to developers to build over 55 plus communities. And we in New Hampshire know we've been invaded from all over with developers that think this is a great place to retire. What can we do to educate them to understand that multi-generational living is so important to us as we age?
Well, I'm not equipped to answer that on the political level, but luckily New Hampshire has you on that count. I think that, you know, all political change starts within. The most important thing each of us can do is to look at our own attitudes towards our own aging and see how you use the words old and young. Think about starting a consciousness-raising group. On my website, which is thischairrocks.com, the resources, the first resource is a booklet called Who Me, Ageist? How to Start a Consciousness-Raising Group. Because it was through consciousness-raising that the women's movement got catalyzed. Because what happened was women came together and realized that what they had been thinking of as personal problems, about their bodies, their families, their salaries, whatever, were widely shared political problems that required collective action. We are not there on the ageism front yet, which is why we think when we can't open a bottle or there's no handrail, it's our fault. It's not our fault. Those are the result of bad policies, right? And building codes and whatever. But we need a grassroots movement from all of us to say to builders, no, we don't want to be segregated into an old age ghetto. Thank you very much. We're not going to buy your properties. Not because we're this, it's tricky because there is a lot of age denial around the aging in place movement. I can argue any topic here from both sides. People want to stay in their home, but it's also important to remember that stuff is going to change your capacity, and that to make sure that aging in place isn't a way of deferring addressing those changes, and also isn't a recipe for social isolation. The most important component of aging well is not how healthy you are or how rich you are, but whether you have a strong social network. So I would say to those developers, I need a strong social network, and I need it to be all ages. I need people to outlive me, right? And I need people, there's a great quote in the book from the Dutch gerontologist that says, autonomy requires collaborators, right? We're gonna need people to help us. So old people community does not put that foundation in place, and it's not what we want.
Thank you, Ashton. You've been very thought-provoking, hopefully very, very stimulating. Sign up for her email and also look at engagingnewhampshire.org and sign up for our free newsletter that will give you ammunition to bring the fight forward. Thank you. You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org and keep up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook. Next Sunday's presentation is on the role of music in political resistance in America. Columbia professor and author David Haidu and activist-songwriter Jill Sobel will be speaking. Thank you again, Ashton. Please now join us in the parish hall. We ask that if you had a question that wasn't addressed, now's a chance to ask her personally. And join us for refreshments. They've been provided by Summerhill Assisted Living. And I also want to mention the beautiful flowers here. They are from John's Plot at Newbanusik Neighborhood and Farm. So thank you for coming out on such a gorgeous day. You've made some really lively dialogue. Add your email to the clipboard to get on Ashton's list. And don't forget to leave your blue card and a donation should you so be inclined. Thank you. Okay.